Or at least that's the initial impression. I hate to admit it, but my dad was right about the countryside. Hugh and I didn't see much of it, but we wouldn't have seen anything were it not for a woman named Pat, who was born in Melbourne and has lived there for most of her life. We'd met her a few years earlier in Paris, where she taught us the term shout, as in, I'm shouting lunch. This means that you're treating and that you don't want any lip about it. You can also say, it's my shout, or I'll shout the next round, she told us. We kept in touch after her visit, and when my book tour ended, and I was given a day and a half to spend as I liked, Pat offered herself as a guide. On that first afternoon, she showed us around Melbourne and shouted coffee. The following morning, she picked us up at our hotel and drove us into what she called the bush. I expected a wasteland of dust and human bones. But in fact, it was nothing like that. When Australians say the bush, they mean the woods, the forest. First, though, we had to get out of Melbourne and drive beyond the seemingly endless suburbs. It was August, the dead of winter, and so we had the windows rolled up. The homes we passed were made of wood, many with high fences around the backyards. They didn't look exactly like American houses, but I couldn't quite identify the difference. Is it the roofs, I wondered, the siding? Pat was driving, and as we passed a turnoff for a shopping center, she invited us to picture a four-burner stove. Gas or electric, Hugh asked, and she said that it didn't matter. This was not a real stove, but a symbolic one, used to prove a point at a management seminar she had once attended. One burner represents your family, one is your friends, the third is your health, and the fourth is your work. The gist, she said, was that in order to be successful, a person has to cut off one of his burners. And in order to be really successful, you have to cut off two. Pat has her own business, a good one that's allowing her to retire at 55. She owns three houses and two cars, but even without the stuff, she seems like a genuinely happy person. And that alone constitutes success. I asked which two burners she had cut off, and she said that the first to go had been family. After that, she switched off her health. How about you? I thought for a moment and said that I'd cut off my friends. There's nothing to be proud of, but after meeting Hugh, I quit making an effort. What else? She asked. Health, I guess. Hugh's answer was work. And? Just work, he said. I asked Pat why she'd cut off her family, and with no trace of bitterness, she talked about her parents, severe alcoholics, the both of them. They drank away their jobs and their credit. Because they were broke, they moved a lot, most often in the middle of the night. This made it hard to have a pet, though for a short time, Pat and her sister managed to own a sheep. It was an old beat-up ram they named Mr. Preston. He was lovely and good-natured until my father sent him off to be shorn, Pat said. When he returned, there were bald patches and horrible deep cuts like stab wounds in his skin. Then we moved to an apartment and had to get rid of him. She looked at her hands on the steering wheel. Poor old Mr. Preston. I hadn't thought about him in years. It was around this time that we finally entered the bush. Hugh pointed out the window at a still lump of dirty fur lying beside a fallen tree, and Pat caroled, "Roadkill!" Then she pulled over so we could take a closer look. Since leaving Melbourne, we'd been climbing higher into the foothills. The temperature had dropped, and on the ground were graying patches of snow. I had on a sweater and a jacket, but it wasn't quite enough, and I shivered as we walked toward the body and saw that it was a what exactly? A teenage kangaroo? A wallaby, Pat corrected me. The thing had been struck but not run over. It hadn't decomposed or been disfigured, and I was surprised by the shoddiness of its coat. It was as if you'd bred a rabbit with a mule. Then there was the tail, which reminded me of a lance. Hugh, I called. Come here and look at the wallaby. It's his belief that in marveling at a dead roadside animal, you may as well have killed it yourself. not accidentally, but on purpose, cackling most likely as he ran it down. Therefore, he stayed in the car. "It's your loss," I called, and a great cloud of steam issued from my mouth. Our destination that afternoon was a place called Dalesford, which looked, when we arrived, more like a movie set than an actual working town. The buildings on the main street were two stories tall and made of wood, like buildings in the Old West, but brightly painted. Here was the shop selling handmade soaps shaped like pettifours. Here was the fudgery, the jammery, your source for moisturizer. If Dodge City had been founded and maintained by homosexuals, this is what it might have looked like. "The spas are fantastic," Pat said. And she parked the car in front of a puppet shop. From there, we walked down a slight hill, passing along the way a flock of sulfur-crested cockatoos, not caged, but just milling about, pulling worms from the front lawn of a bed and breakfast. This was the moment when familiarity slipped away, and Australia seemed not just distant, but impossibly foreign. I couldn't imagine looking out my window and seeing these things, but stranger still would be getting used to them, taking them for granted. It was Pat who made the lunch reservation. The restaurant was attached to a hotel, and on arriving, we were seated beside a picture window. The view was of a wooden deck, and immediately beyond it, a small lake. On a sunny day, it was probably blinding, but the winter sky was like brushed aluminum. The water beneath it had the same dull sheen, and its surface reflected nothing. Even before the menus were handed out, you could see what sort of a place this was. Order the pork, and it might resemble a rough-hewn raft, stranded by tides on a narrow beach of polenta. Fish might come with shredded turnips or a pablum of coddled fruits. The younger an ingredient, the more highly it was valued, thus the baby chicken, the baby spinach, the newborn asparagus, each pale stalk as slender as a fang. Like always in a fancy restaurant, I asked Hugh to order for me. "Whatever you think," I tell him, "just so long as there's no chocolate in it." I used to say this only with dessert, but now you never know. He and Pat weighed our options, and I watched the hostess seat a party of eight. Bringing up the rear was a woman in her mid-30s, pretty and with a baby on her shoulder. The back of it was covered with a shawl, but judging from the size, it looked pretty young, a month old, tops. "Keep it away from the chef," I thought. Hugh showed me a funny word combination on the menu, and when I returned my attention to the table of newcomers, I saw that the child hadn't shifted position. Its mother was running her hand over its back, purposefully almost, as if she were feeling for a switch. And when the top of the shawl fell away, I saw that this was not a baby, but a baby doll. "Psst," I whispered. And when Pat raised her eyes, I directed them to the other side of the room. "Is that normal in Australia?" She took in the doll and guessed it to be a form of therapy. "Maybe it's a grieving thing. Maybe she lost a baby in childbirth, and this is helping her to work through it." There's a definite line between looking and staring. And after I was caught crossing it, I turned toward the window. On the highest rail of the deck was a wooden platform, and standing upon it, looking directly into my eyes, was what I knew to be a kookaburra. There's a children's song about these birds, and though it alludes to their call, it fails to mention their remarkable size. This one was as big as a seagull, but squatter, squarer, and all done up in earth tones, the full spectrum from beige to dark walnut. When seen full on, the feathers atop his head looked like brush-cut hair, and that gave him a brutish, almost a conservative look. If owls were the professors of the avian kingdom, then kookaburras, I thought, might well be the gym teachers. Well, will you look at that, I said. When the waitress arrived, I pointed out the window and asked her a half a dozen questions, all of them fear-based. Oh, she said, that bird's not going to hurt anybody. She took our orders, and then she must have spoken to one of the waiters. He was a tall fellow, college-aged, and he approached our table with a covered bowl in his hands. I assumed it was an appetizer, but it seemed instead that it was for the kookaburra. Would you like to step outside and feed him? He asked. I wanted to say that between the wallaby and the baby doll, I was already overstimulated. But how often in life do you get such an offer? That's how I found myself on the deck, holding what turned out to be a bowl of raw duck meat, cut into slender strips. At the sight of it, the bird stood up and flew onto my arm, which buckled slightly beneath his weight. Don't be afraid, the waiter said. And he talked to the kookaburra in a soothing, respectful voice, the way you might to a child with a switchblade in his hand. For that's what this thing's beak was, a serious weapon. I held a strip of raw duck, and after yanking it from my fingers, the bird flew back to the railing. Then he took the meat and began slamming it against his wooden platform. Whap! 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 Over and over, as if he were tenderizing it. This is what he'd do in the wild with snakes and lizards and such, the waiter said. He thinks it's still alive, see? He thinks he's killing it. The kookaburra must have slammed the meat against the wooden platform a good 10 times. Only then did he swallow it and look up expectantly for more. I took another strip from the bowl, and the action repeated itself. Whap! 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 On or about his third helping, I got used to the feel of a bird on my arm and started thinking about other things. Starting with the word kookaburra. I first heard it in the 5th grade when our music teacher went on an Australian kick. She taught us to sing Waltzing Matilda, Tie Me Kangaroo Down, and what we called simply kookaburra. Taken as a whole, I had never heard such craziness in my life. The first song, for instance, included the words jumbuck, billabong, swagman, and tucker bag, none of which were ever explained. The more nonsensical the lyric, the harder it was to remember. And that, most likely, is why I retained the song about the kookaburra. It was less abstract than the others. I recall that after school that day, I taught it to my sister Amy, who must have been in the 1st grade at the time. We sang it in the car, we sang it at the table, and then one night, we sang it in her bed, the two of us laying side by side and rocking back and forth. Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree. We'd been at it for 30 minutes when the door flung open. What the hell is going on? It was our father, one hand resting teapot style on his hip, and the other, what would be the spout, formed into a fist. He was dressed in his standard around-the-house outfit, which is to say, his underpants. No matter the season, he wore them without a shirt or socks, the way a baby might pad about in a diaper. For as long as any of us could remember, this was the way it went. He returned home from work and stepped out of his slacks, sighing with relief, as if they were oppressive. Like high heels. All said, my father looked good in his underpants, better than the guys in the Penny's catalog, who were, in my opinion, consistently weak in the leg department. Silhouetted in the doorway, he resembled a wrestler, maybe not one in tip-top condition, but he was closer than any of the other dads on our street. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, for God's sake. David, get to your room. Lucidaris, claiming it was 1 a.m., meant that it was, at best, 10:30. Still, though, there was no point in arguing. Down in the basement, I went to my room, and he resumed his position in front of the TV. Within a few minutes, he was snoring, and I crept back upstairs to join Amy for another 20 rounds. Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree. Mary, Mary, king of the bush is he. It didn't take long for our father to rally. Did I not tell you to go to your room? What would strike me afterwards was the innocence of it. If I had children and they stayed up late, singing a song about a bird, I believe I would find it charming. I knew I had those two for a reason. I think I would say to myself, I might go so far as to secretly record them, make a tape and submit it in a My Kids Are Cuter Than Yours competition. My dad, though, clearly didn't see it that way, which was strange to me. It's not like we were ruining his TV reception. He couldn't even hear us from that distance. So what did he have to complain about? All right, Sonny, I'm giving you 10 seconds. 1, 2. I guess what he resented was being dismissed. Had our mother told us to shut up, we probably would have done it. Him, though, sitting around in his underpants, just didn't seem that important. At the count of 6, I pushed back the covers. I'm going, I said. And once again, I followed my father downstairs. 10 minutes later, I was back. Amy cleared a space for me, and we picked up where we had left off. Laugh, kookaburra, laugh, kookaburra, gay your life must be. Actually, maybe it was that last bit that bothered him. An 11-year-old boy in bed with his sister. Not just singing about a bird, but doing it as best he could, rocking back and forth, and imagining himself on stage, possibly wearing a cape, and performing before a multitude. The third time he came into the room, our father was a wild man. Even worse, he was wielding a prop, the dreaded fraternity paddle. It looked like a beaver's tail made out of wood. There were Greek letters burned into one side, and crowded around them were the signatures of other Beta Epsilons, men we'd never met, with old-fashioned nicknames like Lefty and Slivers. Names, to me, as synonymous with misfortune as Smith and Wesson. Our father didn't bring out the paddle very often, but when he did, he always used it. All right, you, let's get this over with. Amy knew that she had nothing to worry about. He was after me, the instigator, and so she propped herself against the pillows, drawing up her legs as I scooted to the other side of the bed, then stood there, dancing from foot to foot. It was the worst possible strategy, as evasion only made him angrier. Still, though, who in his right mind would surrender to such a punishment? He got me eventually, catching me in the legs. Then down I went, and he moved in on my upper thigh. Whap! 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 And while it certainly hurt, I have to say that he didn't go overboard. He never did. I asked him about it once when I was around 14, and he chalked it up to a combination of common sense and remarkable self-control. I know that if I don't stop myself early, I'll kill you. As always, after a paddling, I returned to my room, vowing to never, ever talk to my father again. To hell with him, to hell with my mother, who'd done nothing to stop him, to hell with Amy for not taking a few licks herself, and to hell with the others who were, by now, certainly whispering about it. I didn't have the analogy of the stovetop back then, but what I'd done was turn off the burner marked family. Then I'd locked my door and sat there simmering, knowing even then that without them, I was nothing. Not a son or a brother, but just a boy. And how could that ever be enough? As a full-grown man, it seems no different. Cut off your family, and how would you know who you are? Cut them off in order to gain success, and how could that success be measured? What would it possibly mean? I thought of this as, finally full, the kookaburra swallowed his last strip of duck meat and took off over the lake. Inside the restaurant, our first courses had arrived, and I watched through the window as Hugh and Pat considered their plates. I should have gone inside right then, but I needed another minute to take it all in and acknowledge, if only to myself, that I really did have it made. A storybook town on the far side of the world. Enough in my pocket to shout a fancy lunch, and the sound of that bird in the distant trees, laughing, laughing. Just a quick email. Hey, Robin. Just a quick email to thank you for the wedding gift, or wedding gift certificate, I guess I should say. Two free pizzas. How thoughtful of you. And how generous. Any toppings we want. Maybe you hadn't heard that I'd registered at Tunbridge and Colchester. Last June, I think it was, just before we announced the engagement. Not that the pizzas didn't come in handy. They did, though in a slightly indirect way. Unlike you, who's so wonderfully unconcerned with what other people think, I'm a bit vain, especially when it comes to my figure. That being the case, I use the certificates to feed our workmen, who are currently building a small addition. I know you thought our house was big enough already. Terra meets dress barn was how I heard you so cleverly describe it at the wedding. I mean, really, you said, how much room do two people need? Or did you say two thin people? Well, with the band playing and everyone in the world shouting their congratulations, it was a little hard to hear, just like it is at our ever-expanding house, the workers all hammering away. What they've done is tear down the wall between the kitchen and the breakfast nook. That'll give us room for a walk-in silverware drawer and this new 16-burner stove I've been eyeing. Plus, it will allow us to expand the counter space, put in a second dishwasher, and install an electric millstone for grinding blue corn. Homemade tortillas, anyone? Then we're going to enclose that useless deck, insulate it, and create a separate dining room for when we go Asian. This will eliminate that ramp you're so fond of, but it's not like we see you all that often, and I don't think it will kill you to crawl up a half a dozen stairs. As a matter of fact, as long as they're clean, I actually think it might be good for you. Seeing as we're on this subject, Robin, is it right to insist on all this special treatment? More than that, is it healthy? It's been almost a year since the car accident. Don't you think it's time you moved on with your life? Do I need to remind you of all my injuries? The dislocated shoulder, the practically broken wrist that still tingles when I do something strenuous like whisk in damp weather. On top of that, it took me days to wash your blood out of my hair. The admitting nurse put me down as a redhead. That's how bad it was, your left front tooth practically embedded in my skull. It's no severed spinal cord, of course, but like Dr. Gaffney says, the ball is in your court now. You can either live in the past as a lonely, bitter paraplegic, or you can live in the present as one. I dusted myself off and got back on the proverbial horse, so why can't you? In other news, did you get the postcard I sent from our honeymoon? Iraq was beautiful, just as I imagined it would be, but there were so many Americans there. I said to Philip, is nowhere safe? I mean, really, in terms of the crowds, we might as well have gone to Paris. Then, of course, we did go to Paris, but it was for work rather than vacation. Philip had a client he needed to meet, an American in town for some big Chablis auction. He once defended her on a drunk driving charge, and successfully, too, this despite her breathalyzer results and some pretty bad behavior, some of which was caught on video. Now they're suing the people she hit, or at least the one who lived, and it looks like they've got a fairly good chance of winning. This is not to worry you in any way. But with the addition on our house and the 1.5 million other things on my to-do list, a lawsuit is the last thing on my mind. Not that it wasn't proposed. While my hard-working husband consulted with his client, I alone wandered the quays, stopping every now and then to duck into a boutique. And more than once I thought of you. For Paris, I remembered, is where you and Philip honeymooned. That was in the good old days when the dollar and the euro were practically even. Now it costs a king's ransom just for a cup of coffee and a croque madame, so a pair of shoes from Christian Louboutin, well, you can just imagine. I suppose that for you it would make sense, but for someone who walks the way I do, someone known to practically gallop when there's a sale taking place, the shoes I got are good for one, maybe two seasons at the most. Still, though, what could I do? Iraq had been totally picked over by the time we arrived, and I wanted a little something to remind me of my trip. After returning stateside, Philip went right to work. His number one job, to make me happy. First, we started on the addition. Then came a successful effort to erase that DWI from my driving record. It wasn't easy, but legal matters rarely are. All I can say is that if it helps to have friends, it helps even more to have friends who are governors. None of this will get you out of your wheelchair, but it will restore my self-confidence and what I like to think of as my good name. It means as well that you'll have to stop calling me the drunken bitch who took away your legs and then stole your husband. Drunk, it seems, is a relative term. And if I were you, I'd watch how I used it. The leg bit is an exaggeration, as you clearly still have them, big purple veins and all. As for the stealing, Philip came to me on his own volition, one adult to another, no coercion involved. In the end, all you're left with is a single word, bitch, which could mean any number of things. I myself would use it to describe someone whose idea of an appropriate wedding present is a gift certificate for two pizzas. Offering it to your ex-husband, I can understand, but to your own sister, that's just tacky. Gotta run. Rhonda. A guy walks into a bar car. In the golden age of American travel, the platforms of train stations were knee-deep in what looked like fog. You see it all the time in black and white movies, these low-lying eddies of silver. I always thought it was steam from the engines, but now I wonder if it didn't come from cigarettes. You could smoke everywhere back then, in the dining car, in your sleeping berth. Depending on your preference, it was either absolute heaven or absolute hell. I know there was a smoking car on the Amtrak I took from Raleigh to Chicago in 1984, but 7 years later it was gone. By then, if you wanted a cigarette, your only option was to head for the bar. It sounds all right in passing, romantic even, the bar on the Lakeshore Limited. But in fact, it was rather depressing. Too bright, too loud, and full of alcoholics who commandeered the seats immediately after boarding and remained there, marinating like cheap kebabs, until they reached their destinations. At first, their voices might strike you as jolly, the warm tones of strangers becoming friends. Then the drinkers would get sloppy and repetitive, settling finally on that cross-eyed mush that passes for alcoholic sincerity. On the train I took from New York to Chicago in early January 1991, one of the drunks pulled down his pants and shook his bare bottom at the woman behind the bar. I was 34, old enough to know better, yet I laughed along with everyone else. The trip was interminable, almost 19 hours, not counting any delays, but nothing short of a derailment could have soured my good mood. I was off to see the boyfriend I'd left behind when I moved to New York. We'd known each other for 6 years, and though we'd broken up more times than either of us could count, there was the hope that this visit might reunite us. Then he'd join me for a fresh start in Manhattan, and all our problems would disappear. It was best for both of us that it didn't work out that way, though of course I couldn't see it at the time. The trip designed to bring us back together tore us apart for good, and it was a considerably sorrier me that boarded the Limited back to New York. My train left Union Station in the early evening. The late January sky was the color of pewter, and the ground beneath it, as flat as rolled-out dough, was glazed with slush. I watched as the city receded into the distance, and then I went to the bar car for a cigarette. Of the dozen or so drunks who'd staggered on board in Chicago, one in particular stood out. I've always had an eye for ruined-looking men, and that's what attracted me to this guy. I'll call him Johnny Ryan, the sense that he'd been kicked around. Once he hit 30, a hardness would likely settle about his mouth and eyes, but as it was, at 29, he was right on the edge, a screw-top bottle of wine the day before it turns to vinegar. It must have been he who started the conversation, as I'd never have had the nerve. Under different circumstances, I might have stammered hello and run back to my seat, but my breakup convinced me that something major was about to happen. The chance of a lifetime was coming my way, and in order to accept it, I needed to loosen up, to stop being so rigid. That was what my former boyfriend had called me. He'd thrown in judgmental while he was at it, another of those synonyms for no fun at all. The fact that it stung reaffirmed what I had always suspected. It was all true. No one was duller, more prudish, and set in his ways than I was. Johnny didn't strike me as gay, but it was hard to tell with alcoholics. Like prisoners and shepherds, many of them didn't care who they had sex with, the idea being that what happens in the dark stays in the dark. It's the next morning you have to worry about, the name-calling, the slamming of doors, the charge that you somehow cast a spell. I must have been desperate to think that such a person would lead me to a new life. Not that Johnny was bad company. It's just that the things we had in common were also depressing. Unemployment, for instance. My last job had been as an elf at Macy's. Personal assistant was how I phrased it, hoping he wouldn't ask for whom. Santa? His last job had involved hazardous chemicals. An accident at Thanksgiving had caused boils to rise on his back. A few months before that, a tankard of spilled benzene had burned all the hair off his arms and hands. This only made him more attractive. I imagined those smooth pink mitts of his opening the door to the rest of my life. "So you're just going to stand here smoking all night?" he asked. Normally I waited until 9 o'clock to start drinking, but what the heck, I said. I'll have a beer, why not? When a couple of seats opened up, Johnny and I took them. Across the narrow carriage, a black man with a bushy mustache pounded on his formica tabletop. "So a nun goes into town," he said, "and sees a sign reading, Quickies, $25. Not sure what it means, she walks back to the convent and pulls aside the Mother Superior. "Excuse me," she asks, "but what's a quickie?" And the old lady goes, $25, just like in town. As the room filled with laughter, Johnny lit a fresh cigarette. "Some comedian," he said. I don't know how we got into the subject of gambling. Perhaps I asked if he had a hobby. "I'll bet on sporting events, on horses and greyhounds. Hell, put two fleas on the table and I'll bet over which one can jump the highest. How about you?" Gambling to me is what a telephone pole might be to a groundhog. He sees that it's there, but he doesn't for the life of him understand why. Friends have tried to explain the appeal, but still I don't get it. Why take chances with money? Johnny had gone to Gamblers Anonymous, but the whining got on his nerves and he quit after his third meeting. Now he was on his way to Atlantic City, where he hoped to clean up at the blackjack tables. "All right," called the black man on the other side of the carriage. "I got another one. What do you have if you have nuts on a wall?" He lit a cigarette and blew out the match. "Walnuts." A red-nosed woman in a decorative sweatshirt started talking, but the black fellow told her he wasn't done yet. "What do you have if you have nuts on your chest?" He waited a beat. "Chestnuts." "And what do you have if you have nuts on your chin?" He looked from face to face.
A dick in your mouth. Now that's good, Johnny said. I'll have to remember that. I'll have to remind you, I told him, trembling a little at my forwardness. I mean, I'm pretty good at holding on to jokes. As the black man settled down, I asked Johnny about his family. It didn't surprise me that his mother and father were divorced. Each of them was 54 years old, and each was currently living with someone much younger. My dad's girlfriend, fiancée, I guess I should call her, was no older than me, Johnny said. Before losing my job, I had my own place, but now I'm living with them, just, you know, till I get back on my feet. I nodded. My mom, meanwhile, is a total mess, he said. Total pothead, total motor mouth, total perfect match for her asshole 30-year-old boyfriend. Nothing in this guy's life sounded normal to me. Take food. He could recall his mother rolling joints on the kitchen table, but he couldn't remember her cooking a single meal, not even on holidays. For dinner, they'd eat takeout hamburgers or pizzas or sometimes a sandwich slapped together over the sink. Johnny didn't cook either. Neither did his father or future stepmother. I asked what was in their refrigerator, and he said ketchup, beer, mixers, what else? He had no problem referring to himself as an alcoholic. It's just a fact, he said. I have blue eyes and black hair, too. Big deal. Here's a clean one, the black man said. Fried egg sandwich, walks into a bar and orders a drink. The bartender looks him up and down, then goes, sorry, but we don't serve food here. Oh, that's old, one of his fellow drunks said. Not only that, but it's supposed to be a hamburger, not a fried egg sandwich. It's supposed to be food, is what it's supposed to be, the black man told him. As to what that food is, I'll make it whatever the hell I want to. Amen, Johnny said, and the black man gave him a thumbs up. His next joke went over much better. What did the leper say to the prostitute? Keep the tip. I pictured what looked like a mushroom cap resting in the palm of an outstretched hand. Then I covered my mouth and laughed so hard that beer trickled out of my nose. I was just mopping it up when the last call was announced, and everyone raced to the counter to stock up. Some of the drinkers would be at it until morning, when the bar reopened, while others would find their assigned seats and sleep for a while before returning. As for Johnny, he had a fifth of Smirnoff in his suitcase. I had two Valiums in mine, and because I have never much cared for sedatives, the decision to share them came easily. An hour later, it was agreed that we needed to smoke some pot. Each of us was holding, so the only question was where to smoke it and how to get there from the bar. Since taking the Valium, drinking six beers, and following them with straight vodka, walking had become a problem for me. I don't know what it took to bring down Johnny, but he wasn't even close yet. That's what comes with years of socking it away. You should be unconscious, but instead you're up and full of bright ideas. I think I got a place we can go to, he said. I'm not sure why he chose the women's lounge rather than the men's. Perhaps it was closer, or maybe there was no men's lounge. One way or the other, even now, all these many years later, it shames me to think of it. The idea of holing up in a bathroom, of hogging the whole thing just so you can hang out with someone who will never, under any circumstances, return your interest, makes me cringe. Especially given that this, the dressing room it was called, was Amtrak's one meager attempt to recapture some glamour. It amounted to a small chamber with a window, a space not much bigger than a closet. There was an area to sit while brushing your hair or applying makeup, and a mirror to look into while you did it. A second inner door led to a sink and toilet, but we kept that shut and installed ourselves on the carpeted floor. Johnny had brought our plastic cups from the bar, and after settling in, he poured us each a drink. I felt boneless, as if I'd been filleted, yet still I managed to load the pipe and hold the lighter to the bowl. Looking up through the window, I could see the moon, which struck me in my half-conscious state as flat and unnaturally bright, a sort of glowing Pringle. Do you think we can turn that overhead light off? I asked. No problem, Chief. It was he who brought up the subject of sex. One moment I was asking if his mom gave him a discount on his drugs, and the next thing I knew he was telling me about a woman he'd recently slept with. A fatty, he called her. A bloodsucker. Johnny also told me that the older he got, the harder it was to get it up. I'll be totally into it, and then it's like, what the fuck, you know? Oh, definitely, I said. He poured more vodka into his plastic cup and swirled it around as if it were a fine cognac that needed to breathe. You get into a lot of fights, he asked. Arguments? No, he said, I mean, with your fists. You ever punch people? I relit the pipe and thought of the dust-up my former boyfriend and I had had before I left. It was the first time since the fifth grade that I'd hit someone not directly related to me, and it left me feeling like a grade-A moron. This had a lot to do with my punch, which was actually more of a slap. To make it worse, I then slipped on the icy sidewalk and fallen into a bank of soft gray snow. There was no need to answer Johnny's fistfight question. The subject had been raised for his benefit rather than mine, an excuse to bemoan the circumference of his biceps. Back when he was boxing, the one on the right had measured 17.5 inches. Now it's less than 14, he told me. I'm shrinking before my very fucking eyes. Well, can't you fatten it back up somehow, I asked. You're young. I mean, how hard can it be to gain weight? The problem isn't gaining weight, it's gaining in the right places, Johnny said. 2 6-packs a day might swell my stomach, but it's not doing shit for my arms. Maybe you could lift the cans for a while before opening them, I offered. That should count for something, shouldn't it? Johnny flattened his voice. You're a regular comedian, aren't you? Keep it up and maybe you can open for that asshole in the bar. A minute of silence and then he relit the pipe, took a hit, and passed it my way. Look at us, he said, and he let out a long sigh. Couple of first-class fucking losers. I wanted to defend myself, to at least point out that we were in second class, but then somebody knocked on the door. Go away, Johnny said. Bathroom's closed till tomorrow. A minute later, there came another knock, this one harder, and before we could respond, a key turned and a security guard entered. It wouldn't have worked to deny anything. The room stunk of pot and cigarette smoke. There was a half-empty bottle of vodka, the plastic cups turned on their sides. Put a couple of lampshades on our heads and the picture would have been complete. I suppose the guard could have made some trouble, confiscated our dope, had us arrested at the next stop, but instead he just told us to take a hike. No easy feat on a train. Johnny and I parted without saying goodnight, I staggering off to my assigned seat, and he going, I assumed, to his. I saw him again the following morning, back in the bar car. Whatever spell had been cast the night before was broken, and he was just another alcoholic, starting his day with a shot and a chaser. As I ordered a coffee, the black man told a joke about a witch with one breast. I'll give it a rest, the woman in the decorative sweatshirt said. I smoked a few cigarettes and then returned to my seat, nursing what promised to be a 2-day headache. While slumped against the window, trying unsuccessfully to sleep, I thought of a trip to Greece I'd taken in August 1982. I was 25 that summer, and flew by myself from Raleigh to Athens. A few days after arriving, I was joined by my father, my brother, and my sister Lisa. The four of us traveled around the country, and when they went back to North Carolina, I took a bus to the port city of Patras. From there, I sailed to Brindisi, Italy, wondering all the while why I hadn't returned with the rest of my family. In theory, it was wonderful, a European adventure. I was too self-conscious to enjoy it, though, too timid, and it stymied me that I couldn't speak the language. A bilingual stranger helped me buy a train ticket to Rome, but on the return to Brindisi, I had no one but myself to rely on. The man behind the counter offered me 3 options, and I guess I said yes to the one that meant, no seat for me, thank you. I would like to be packed as tightly as possible alongside people with no access to soap or running water. It was a common request, at least among the young and foreign. I heard French, Spanish, German, and a good many languages I couldn't quite identify. What was that that sounded like English played backward? Dutch? Swedish? If I found the crowd intimidating, it had more to do with my insecurity than with the way anyone treated me. I suppose the others seemed more deserving than I did, with their faded bandanas and goatskin bags sagging with wine. While I counted the days until I could go back home, they seemed to have a real talent for living. When I was a young man, my hair was dark brown and a lot thicker than it is now. I had one continuous eyebrow instead of two separate ones, and this made me look as though I sometimes rode a donkey. It sounds odd to say it, conceited even, but I was cute that August when I was 25. I wouldn't have said so at the time, but reviewing pictures taken by my father in Athens, I think, that was me? Really? Looks-wise, I feel that single month constituted my moment, a peak from which the descent has been both swift and merciless. It's only 350 miles from Rome to Brindisi, but what with the constant stopping and starting, the train took forever. We left, I believe, at around 8:30 p.m., and for the first few hours, everyone stood. Then we sat with our legs crossed, folding them in a little bit tighter when one person and then another decided to lie down. As my fellow passengers shifted position, I found myself pushed toward the corner where I brushed up against a fellow named Bashir. Lebanese, he said he was, en route to a small Italian university where he planned to get a master's in engineering. Bashir's English was excellent, and in a matter of minutes we formed what passes between wayfarers in a foreign country as a kind of automatic friendship. More than a friendship, actually. A romance. Coloring everything was this train, its steady rumble as we passed through the dark Italian countryside. Bashir was, how to describe him, it was as if you had coaxed the eyes out of Bambi and resettled them, half asleep, into a human face. Nothing hard or ruined-looking there. In fact, it was just the opposite. Angelic, you might call him. Pretty. What was it that he and I talked about so intently? Perhaps the thrill was that we could talk, that our tongues, each flabby from lack of exercise, could flap and make sounds in their old familiar way. 3 hours into our conversation, he invited me to get off the train in his college town and spend some time, as much as I liked, in the apartment that was waiting for him. It wasn't the offer you'd make to a backpacker, but something closer to a proposal. Be with me, was the way I interpreted it. At the end of our train car was a little room, no more than a broom closet, really, with a barred window in it. It must have been 4 a.m. when two disheveled Germans stepped out, and we moved in to take their place. As would later happen with Johnny Ryan, Bashir and I sat on the floor, the state of which clearly disgusted him. Apart from the fact that we were sober and were pressed so close that our shoulders touched, the biggest difference was that our attraction was mutual. The moment came when we should have kissed. You could practically hear the surging strings, but I was too shy to make the first move, and so, I guessed, was he. Still, I could feel this thing between us, not just lust, but a kind of immediate love, the sort that, like instant oatmeal, can be realized in a matter of minutes and is just as nutritious as the real thing. We'll kiss now, I kept thinking. Then, okay, now. And on it went, more torturous by the second. The sun was rising as we reached his destination, the houses and church spires of this strange city, a city I could make my own, silhouetted against the weak morning sky. And so, he asked. I don't remember my excuse, but it all came down to cowardice. For what, really, did I have to return to? A job pushing a wheelbarrow on Raleigh construction sites? A dumpy one-bedroom next to the IHOP. Bashir got off with his three big suitcases and became a perennial lump in my throat, one that arises whenever I hear the word Lebanon or see its jittery outline on the evening news. Is that what you went back to, I wonder? Do I ever cross your mind? Are you even still alive? Given the short amount of time we spent together, it's silly how often and how tenderly I think of him. All the way to Penn Station, hungover from my night with Johnny Ryan, I wondered what might have happened had I taken Bashir up on his offer. I imagined our apartment overlooking a square, the burbling fountain, the drawings of dams and bridges piled neatly on the desk. When you're young, it's easy to believe that such an opportunity will come again, maybe even a better one. Instead of a Lebanese guy in Italy, it might be a Nigerian one in Belgium, or maybe a Pole in Turkey. You tell yourself that if you traveled alone to Europe this summer, you could surely do the same thing next year and the year after that. Of course you don't, though. And the next thing you know, you're an aging, unemployed elf. So desperate for love, you spend your evening mooning over a straight alcoholic. The closer we got to New York, the more miserable I became. Then I thought of this guy my friend Lily and I had borrowed a ladder from a few months earlier, someone named Hugh. I'd never really trusted people who went directly from one relationship to the next. So after my train pulled into Penn Station, and after I'd taken the subway home, I'd wait a few hours, or maybe even a full day, before dialing his number and asking if he'd like to hear a joke. Standing by. It was one of those headaches that befall every airline passenger. A flight is delayed because of thunderstorms or backed up traffic, or maybe it's canceled altogether. Maybe you board 2 hours late, or maybe you board on time and spend the next 2 hours sitting on the runway. When it happens to you, it's a national tragedy. Why aren't the papers reporting this, you wonder? Only when it happens to someone else do you realize what a dull story it really is. They told us we'd leave at 3 instead of 2:30, so I went to get a frosted pecan wrap. And when I came back, they changed the time to 4 on account of the plane we'd be riding in hadn't left Pittsburgh yet. Then I was like, why didn't you tell us that an hour ago? And they were like, ma'am, just stand away from the counter, please. Because I'm in the air so often, I hear this sort of thing a lot. In line for a coffee, in line for a newspaper or a gunpowder test on the handle of my public radio tote bag. Everywhere I go, someone in an $8 t-shirt is whipping out a cell phone and delivering the fine print of his or her delay. One can't help but listen in, but then my focus shifts and I find myself staring. I should be used to the way Americans dress when traveling, yet still it manages to amaze me. It's as if the person next to you had been washing shoe polish off a pig, then suddenly threw down his sponge, saying, "Fuck this! I'm going to Los Angeles!" On Halloween, when I see the ticket agents dressed as hags and mummies, I no longer think, nice costume, but now we have to tag our own luggage? I mean, that I mistake them for us. The scariness, of course, cuts both ways. I was on a plane in the spring of 2003 when the flight attendant asked us to pray for our troops in Iraq. It was a prickly time, but brand new war or no brand new war, you don't ever want to hear the word pray from a flight attendant. You don't want to hear the phrase, I'll be right back, either. That's code for go fuck yourself. According to a woman who used to fly for Northwest and taught me several terms specific to her profession.
You know how a plastic bottle of water will get all crinkly during a flight? She asked. Well, it happens to people, too. To our insides. That's why we get all gassy. All right, I said. So what me and the other gals would sometimes do is fart while we walked up and down the aisle. No one could hear it on account of the engine noise, but anyway, that's what we called crop dusting. When I asked another flight attendant, this one male, how he dealt with a plane full of belligerent passengers, he said, "Oh, we have our ways. The next time you're flying and it comes time to land, listen closely as we make our final pass down the aisle." In the summer of 2009, I was trying to get from North Dakota to Oregon. There were thunderstorms in Colorado, so we were 2 hours late leaving Fargo. This caused me to miss my connecting flight, and upon my arrival in Denver, I was directed to the customer service line. It was a long one, 30, maybe 35 people, all of them cranky and exhausted. In front of me stood a woman in her mid-70s, accompanying two beautifully dressed children, a boy and a girl. The airlines complain that nobody's traveling, and then you arrive to find your flight's been oversold, the woman griped. I'm trying to get me and my grandkids to San Francisco, and now they're telling us there's nothing until tomorrow morning. At this, her cell phone rang. The woman raised it to her ear, and a great many silver bracelets clattered down her arm. Frank, is that you? What'd you find out? The person on the other end fed her information, and as she struggled to open her pocketbook, I held out my pad and pen. A nice man just gave me something to write with, so go ahead, the woman said. I'm ready. Then I heard, what? Oh, well, I could have told you that. She handed me back my pad and pen, and rolling her eyes, whispered, thanks anyway. After hanging up, she turned to the kids. Your old grandmother is so sorry for putting you through this, but she's going to make it up to you, she swears. They were like children from a catalog. The little girl's skirt was a red and white check and matched the ribbon that banded her straw hat. Her brother was wearing a shirt and tie. It was a clip-on, but still it made him and his sister the best-dressed people in line. Much better than the family 10 or so places ahead of them. That group consisted of a couple in their mid-50s and three teenagers, two of whom were obviously brothers. The third teenager, a girl, was holding a very young baby. I suppose it could have been a loner. But the way she engaged with it, the obvious pride and pleasure she was radiating, led me to believe that the child was hers. Its father, I guessed, was the kid standing next to her. The young man's hair was almost orange and drooped from his head in thin, lank braids. At the end of each one, just above the rubber band, was a colored bead the size of a marble. Stevie Wonder wore his hair like that in the late 70s, but he's black. And blind. Then, too, Stevie Wonder didn't have acne on his neck and wear baggy denim shorts that fell midway between his knees and his ankles. Topping it off was a kid's T-shirt. I couldn't see the front of it, but printed in large letters across the back were the words, "Freaky Motherfucker." That's M-O-T-H-A-F-O-C-K-A. I didn't know where to start with that one. Let's see. I'm flying on a plane with my parents and my infant son, so should I wear the T-shirt that says I wouldn't fuck you for practice? Suck all you want, I'll make more. No. Seeing as I'll have the beaded cornrows, I
think I should go with freaky motherfucker. As the kid reached over and took the baby from the teenage girl, the woman in front of me winced. "Typical," she groaned. "I beg your pardon?" She gestured toward the freaky motherfucker. "The only ones having babies are the ones who shouldn't be having them." Her gaze shifted to the adults. "And look at the stupid grandparents, proud as punch." It was one of those situations I often find myself in while traveling. Something said by a stranger I've been randomly thrown into contact with. And I want to say, listen, I'm with you on most of this. But before we continue, I need to know who you voted for in the last election. If the grandmother's criticism was coming from the same place as mine, if she was just being petty and judgmental, we could go on all day. If, on the other hand, it was tied to a conservative agenda, I was going to have to switch tacks and side with the freaky motherfucker, who was, after all, just a kid. He may have looked like a Dr. Seuss character, but that didn't mean that he couldn't love his baby. A baby, I told myself, who just might grow up to be a Supreme Court justice or president of the United States or at least, I don't know, someone with a job. Of course, you can't just ask someone who they voted for. Sometimes you can tell by looking, but the grandmother with the many bracelets could have gone either way. In the end, I decided to walk the center line. "What gets me is that they couldn't even spell motherfucker right," I whispered. I mean, what kind of an example is that setting for our young people? After that, she didn't want to talk anymore. Not even when the line advanced and motherfucker and company moved to one of the counter positions. Including the baby, there were six in their party, so I knew it was going to take forever. "Where do they need to go anyway?" I asked myself. "Wherever it is, would it have killed them to drive?" Fly enough, and you learn to go brain dead when you have to. It's sort of like time travel. One minute you're bending to unlace your shoes, and the next thing you know, you're paying $14 for a fruit cup, wondering, how did I get here? No sooner had I alienated the grandmother in Denver than I was trapped by the man behind me. He had been passed over for a standby seat earlier that morning and was not happy about it. The gal at the gate said she'd call my name when it came time to board, but hell, she didn't call me. I tried to look sympathetic. "I should have taken her name," the man continued. "I should have reported her. Hell, I should have punched her is what I should have done." "I hear you," I said. Directly behind him was a bald guy with a silver mustache, one of those elaborate jobs that wanders a while before eventually morphing into sideburns. The thing was as curved and bushy as a squirrel's tail, and the man shook crumbs from it as the fellow who'd lost his standby seat turned to engage him. "Goddamn airline. It's no wonder they're going down the toilet." "None of them want to work. That's a problem," the bald man with the mustache said. "All any of them care about is their next goddamn coffee break." He looked at the counter agents with disdain and then turned his eye on the freaky motherfucker. "And that one must be heading back to the circus." "Pathetic," the man behind me said. He himself was wearing pleated khaki shorts and a blue T-shirt. A baseball cap hung from his waistband, and his sneakers, which were white, appeared to be brand new. Like a lot of men you see these days, he looked like a boy, suddenly, shockingly set into an adult body. "We got a kid looks like him back in the town I come from, and every time I see him, I just thank God he had mine." As the two started in on rap music and baggy trousers, I zoned out and thought about my last layover in Denver. I was on the People Mover, jogging toward my connection at the end of Concourse C, when the voice over the PA system asked Adolf Hitler to pick up a white courtesy phone. Did I hear that correctly? I remember thinking. It's hard to imagine anyone calling their son Adolf Hitler, so the person must have changed it from something less provocative. Weirder still was hearing the name in the same sentence as the word courtesy. I imagined a man picking up the receiver, his voice made soft by surprise and the possibility of bad news.